Over the next few minutes of today's morning show, we're going to be exploring one of the most painful kinds of loss that anybody can sustain. We're talking about when one loses a precious loved one to suicide. My guest, Rachel Zimmerman, experienced that heartbreaking loss and bewildering loss a few years ago when her beloved husband, Seth, jumped to his death, leaving behind him not only a wake of great sorrow, but also unanswered, maybe unanswerable questions about exactly why. Why had he felt driven to this act, leaving behind him a wife and daughters who loved him so much? And the story is told in a remarkable book written by my guest, Rachel Zimmerman, a book called Us After, a memoir of love and suicide. Rachel Zimmerman is an award-winning journalist who has written on an array of topics related to medicine and health for many, many years. She was a staff writer for a time for the Wall Street Journal, has been a contributor to the Washington Post, a contributor to Boston's local NPR affiliate. Her work has appeared in many places, including the New York Times, Oprah Magazine, The Atlantic, The Huffington Post. And this book, written through the cooperation of the Santa Fe Writers Project, is an incredible account of what she and her family experienced. And her journey of exploration into trying to have certain questions answered is so powerful and poignant. I deeply appreciate all the care that went into this book, and I'm very appreciative of this opportunity to speak with her about it. And the book, by the way, is published by the Santa Fe Writers Project, again titled Us After, a Memoir of Love and Suicide. Rachel Zimmerman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thank you so much for that generous intro. I'm happy to be here.
I'm so glad that we can have this conversation. I wonder if you could just say a little bit about your life with your husband, Seth, before this suicide, which occurred, I believe, back in 2014.
That's correct.
We'll dig into a lot of specifics, but I think it would be helpful for our listeners to just have at least a basic sort of context into which to place the central story that we'll be talking about.
Of course. So Seth was, as you mentioned, a devoted father. He was a tenured professor of robotics at MIT. He had a big extended family, lots of cousins, two brothers. He was close with his parents and really connected in the MIT community and in our neighborhood community. In other words, he had a robust social network. So not the typical profile of somebody who dies by suicide. We had been together 15 years, married for 12. Our kids were 8 and 11. He was so devoted to the kids. I remember he used to drop them off often in their classes, and he stayed longer than so many of the parents, let alone the fathers. And I remember one of the moms once said to me, "Does he have a real job? Because he stayed so long in the classroom." But he was, you know, on the surface, he was this kind of laid back, ultimate frisbee playing, you know, brilliant engineer. But as a friend of mine recently said to me after reading the book, it was like Seth had a PhD in hiding. I think he was incredibly driven to succeed, and he had unrealistically high expectations for himself. And I think behind that super cool, laid back external presentation, he just put a lot of pressure on himself. And the year he died, he had just turned 50. He had some chronic pain issues, some sciatica, nothing really serious, but it prevented him from doing exercise, and his sleep was interrupted. He was doing this massive international robotics competition right before he died. So there were all these pressures that were building up. He had a thing called tinnitus, which is a ringing in the ears, which for much of his life was just kind of this moderate background, you know, annoyance. But shortly before he died, that escalated. So none of these things in and of themselves pointed to an emergency. But because he had, I think, a lot of trouble asking for help, they coalesced at the end, and he didn't have the tools to cope with this kind of rising mental health crisis. And yeah, so that's a little bit about my theory of what happened. But again, there's a lot of it in the book. That's part of it, was my exploration of trying to figure out what happened, but then ultimately coming to a point where, you know, suicide is inherently a mystery, right? It's like against all of our human impulses. And so at a certain moment after years of digging, I kind of felt like I have to pivot and take care of, you know, rebuilding joy and finding pleasure again in my life and my kids' lives.
Right, exactly. And of course, one of the things that we probably kind of remember is, or start to realize, is that even if your husband had left behind him some sort of note spelling out what he was feeling in this moment, even that, although I suppose in some respects you would have welcomed that. I mean, you would have welcomed any kind of information, even a partial answer to the mystery. But even that would not relieve you or anyone who loved him of first of all, your sorrow. But secondly, even that mystery would remain of how did this happen? Why did this happen? What drove him to this point of ultimate despair?
Right. In fact, he did leave a note. And there's a theme within the book about sort of how the note tormented me, because on the one hand, you know, as you said, you hope for an explanation. You hope it's written all out. But his note didn't provide that. It just sort of pointed to the pain he was in and to the complete loss of perspective. And you'll have to read the book to find out more about that. Your listeners will. But the point was, you know, you just can't be in that person's shoes. And I talked to a lot of suicide researchers and experts and doctors, and they describe a kind of tunnel vision that the person who dies by suicide gets in, where they're not thinking about their kids. They're not thinking about the devastation they'll leave behind. They're just thinking about the sort of psychic pain they're in and how to stop it. And often the difference between people who sort of think about suicide and the ones who complete the act are the ones who truly believe there is no way out of that psychic pain. One doctor compared it to a burning building, and you just feel like there's no way out except to jump. Yeah. And so, you know, what I've begun, you know, what from the very beginning, what I told my kids and what I tell myself and what I actually truly believe is that, you know, he had a mental illness, and the sort of result of this brain illness was that he died by suicide. And, you know, for my kids, I talk about how it's just like cancer, right? We don't say a person with terminal cancer chose to die by having this cancer, right? It's something that happened, you know, their cells just lost control, right? And it was like an illness took over. And similarly, with something like this, there was an illness in his brain. And in some ways, that makes it easier to comprehend. But at the end of the day, I think suicide remains this sort of incomprehensible phenomenon. As I said, it's so anathema to our very human instincts to survive, right? And so I looked for that aha moment that would unlock the mystery of it. I thought maybe he had, you know, some kind of gambling addiction and he lost all our money, or he was having an affair, but, you know, maybe there were some drugs in his system that killed him. But I looked into all of those possibilities and none of that was true. And so, you know, you kind of have to learn to live with the unknowable. It's kind of like knowing and not knowing at the same time. You have to hold both of those, which is not an easy thing to live in or to understand. But I think that that's where I landed on this.
I think it's
and
safe.
That you have to go on. You know, you have to go on. Like, I had these little girls and, you know, and so a lot of the book, it's called Us After, and it's sort of the aftermath and the rebuilding that becomes the focus of the book.
Exactly. I think anybody who experienced what you experienced would feel so much of what you felt. I mean, I don't mean exactly in the same way, but in much the same way. I mean, that kind of devastation. If there's something about your particular loss in your particular situation that maybe was a bit uncommon, is what your line of work was, your vocation. And at one point early in the book, you say, how could I, a professional observer, miss the main story, not even pick up the hints? That is such, and another point in the book, you say, what had I missed? This question became my obsession. I mean, even if you're just a, let's say, you know, just a regular person, a spouse would still feel like they should have noticed. But somehow you felt maybe an even slightly larger burden of guilt, not guilt maybe, but regret, I don't know. But you really felt like you should not have missed this. And it sounds like that was part of your journey, was coming to terms with that.
Yes, guilt, regret, all of the above. I think it's fairly common for the survivors of people who died by suicide to feel somehow like they could have stopped it. I think that's just sort of a natural human impulse. And a lot of people who I've spoken to subsequent to the publishing of this book have told me, oh my God, if I had just come home sooner, if I had just done this or that. So I think that is a common theme. But yes, because I am supposed to be, you know, in my profession, someone who can observe what's going on and understand what might be happening beneath the surface, I don't know if I experienced it in any more profound way than anyone else, but I felt the burden of that very deeply. And I think that's part of the reason why for the first few years, I was pretty obsessed with finding experts. You know, that's what you do as a journalist, right? You don't know everything, but you know the people who do know. And so I had a lot of faith in that process that somehow if I found the person who knew, if I found the right person who had the right information, I would unlock this and then I would understand. I would come to some sort of resolution, which is what you do in an article, right? A news story. You talk to the researchers, you talk to people who have had the illness, and you somehow get a little bit more understanding. But that didn't really work in this situation because even, you know, the top suicide researcher at Harvard who I spoke to told me, you know, we're really no better than a coin toss at this point at predicting who will die by suicide. Among the millions of people with depression, obviously, most of those people don't die, right? And so what are we looking for in that haystack in terms of how we can perhaps predict and prevent this? I mean, so I said some of his symptoms that didn't seem like an emergency sort of escalated in the days before. He did finally, I sort of made him go to his doctor because he was saying that he felt really anxious the days before he died. So we went to his primary care doctor, told him that he was feeling very anxious and that something was going on in his brain, which, of course, I didn't find out till later when I reviewed his medical records.
If I can just interrupt,
yeah,
sorry.
Sure.
I remember you saying that he told his doctor that he was in trouble. He was in
yes.
trouble. And I have to say that of all of the moving moments in your book, for some reason, that just hit me so hard. Just those two words in quotes,
right.
In trouble. So
right. And he didn't tell me, you know, he didn't tell the person who, you know, I don't know. That's another moment where I was sort of like, if I had only known what he told that doctor. But then that doctor walked him over to the mental health department, connected him with a psychiatrist who he had never seen. Seth was not a person to ask for help. He was very pick yourself up by the bootstraps. He was the one people went to for help. But at that moment, the doctor walked him over and connected him with this psychiatrist who had no relationship with Seth, who saw him, you know, for 45 minutes and found out that he was having suicidal thoughts. But Seth told this psychiatrist he would never, ever, ever do anything to harm himself. He loved his children too much. He loved his kids. He was charming. He was calm. I realized after I spoke with her after the fact. And, you know, there was no imminent risk, she wrote in her note that day, no imminent risk of suicide.
Mm.
And then the next day, he ends his life.
Right.
So that's another sort of moment of, you know, extreme guilt, regret, you know, that psychiatrist. I mean, I could only imagine what she felt.
Of course.
First time seeing a patient and the next day he dies. So there was regret all around. And I mean, I even on that day when he was really stressed the day before he died, I got him a massage appointment. And even that massage therapist much later said to me, was there something I did to make him feel bad? You know, as if a massage would trigger someone to do that. But to your point that many people who are left standing after someone they know dies by suicide feel there was something they should have done.
Right. You mentioned that when he is sitting down, I think it is that meeting with that psychiatrist and he's filling out some kind of questionnaire as one does. And there was the question right there in black and white on the page. Do you feel like you might act on these suicidal thoughts or words to that effect? And he emphatically circled no. And you write,
"That's right.
Now I see that answers to questions can be fluid. They can turn false. That an answer can become nothing more than meaningless shapes on a page." I mean, perhaps indeed in that moment, that was his honest answer to that question. Or maybe it wasn't. But even if it was his honest answer to that question, that doesn't mean that's how things would remain.
Exactly. And that researcher from Harvard that I mentioned, you know, spoke of the amount of time that generally lapses between when someone actually decides to die by suicide and then carries it out is very, very quick. You know, it can be a matter of a day or in a couple of hours or, you know, at the most a few days. So there's an impulsive quality to it. And certainly I think that was in play with Seth, although I'll never know what he was actually thinking when he circled that, no, I will never hurt myself on that form.
Hmm.
But, you know, it also could have been like a hopeful thing. Like, I hope I never will, you know, but it could have still been in the back of his mind. I mean, you can really dig yourself into a very deep hole going on about the what ifs and would haves and should haves, and you can really make yourself go kind of crazy over that.
Right. We're speaking
kind of, you know, the rumination, the on and on is really again, a common theme.
And I appreciate how honestly you write about that in your book. For those of you who are just joining us, I'm speaking with Rachel Zimmerman, talking about her memoir, Us After, A Memoir of Love and Suicide. In 2014, her husband, Seth, committed suicide, leaving behind him not only his wife, Rachel, but also two beautiful daughters. And this book is, in part, an exploration of the why behind that inexplicable decision that that Seth made to end his life, and also the story of this family's long journey back to some sort of wholeness in the wake of something so tragic and terrible. One of the things that is intriguing about your husband is the fact that there was so much that was right about his life. And you've already touched on many of those factors. And I think sometimes we very simplistically think of suicide occurring when somebody has an awful life and absolutely no reason for hope, no reason to smile, nothing to be thankful for. And that just wasn't at all the story of your husband's life, as you describe it in your book and as we've already been talking about. What is interesting is that there were certain things about what he was beginning to experience in his life that were maybe a kind of a toxic combination, if not each element in and of itself, something that would directly lead to suicide. For instance, you talk about how this happened shortly after his 50th birthday. And although he was not facing serious health issues, he was facing quite a lot of bothersome issues that come when you've lived half a century. You write, tedious aches and pains undermined Seth's self-image as a laid-back dreamer. In other words, it didn't take kidney failure or a cancer or MS or something that, you know, we would think of as a catastrophic physical problem. But even just the aches and pains of turning 50, which is something, it sounds like you think he found it really hard to accept that and to fold that into who he was and who he was becoming.
Yes, I think you really touched on something important, which is there wasn't anything catastrophic, but I think particularly for men in this culture, there's a taking stock that comes at 50, right? And what have I accomplished? Have I lived up to my expectations of where I should be? And what do I have left? And with that, with sort of the chronic pain and the diminishing of the sort of youthful, robust energy, you start, you know, looking at mortality. And I think for Seth, you know, as you said, it began to undermine his self-image. And I think he believed he couldn't get it back and rise to the point he'd been at. And I think also chronic pain does a number on your psyche, right? And there have been a lot of studies about the mental health effects of chronic pain, right? And how the link between depression and chronic pain. So, you know, I think one of the important takeaways that I found was, as you said, it's not the typical portrait of somebody who's suicidal, right? He wasn't socially isolated. He didn't have, you know, any sort of deep addiction or, you know, anything that, you know, or any kind of material issues like poverty or no major losses in his life that might trigger a downward spiral. But he had these other things that we don't think of, the chronic pain, the lack of sleep, the tinnitus, as I mentioned. And so maybe we need to, as a society, start looking at other kinds of signs. I mean, sleep, I think, is completely undervalued. I mean, I think we're beginning to understand the very, very important role that sleep plays, but he also told his doctor the day before he died that he hadn't slept for more than an hour or two for the past 2 weeks. And I don't know, anybody who's had young children or insomnia, you know, knows what lack of sleep on that level can do to your brain. I mean, you just feel like you can't function.
Right.
And so, yeah.
And on top of it, you tell us also that, I mean, first of all, he was experiencing some significant stress in the work that he did as a robotics professor at MIT. And you tell us that Seth wasn't one to reach for a lifeline. He rarely spoke of his problems. You write at another point, he was masterful at cloaking his stress. In fact, one of the chapters in your book is titled Hiding, and that's what it is mostly about. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. I think we talk about this a fair amount nowadays, and I think particularly about men, who I think there's a long history of guys, not all guys, but many guys, you know, having to kind of be the tough guy, not betraying their emotions or showing their vulnerability and so on. I think we talk about that so much more than we used to. And yet, I don't know that we take the time to talk about the cost of that and of what it can lead to when somebody is experiencing really immense stress in their life and they don't feel like, for whatever reason, they can share that with the world and be open about it. And
absolutely. Totally agree with that. I mean, here he was in this, you know, it was this international robotics competition trying to program a robot to go into disaster situations and do some kind of, you know, do cleanup in, for instance, a toxic, perhaps radioactive, you know, mess, and so that humans wouldn't have to do it. So he's working on doing this for the robot Atlas that he and his students were working on at MIT. And he just would come home so tightly wound, and I'd sort of say, you know, you're a tenured professor at MIT. Like, it doesn't really matter if you win this or not. And he would just lose it and scream at me and be like, yes, it does matter. You know, and so my perspective was just like, my perspective was, can you have some perspective on this? And, you know, he was so intent on winning. And in fact, a couple weeks before his death, they had slightly altered the rules of this competition, and he felt like his strategy was not going to work as well, and that was a big deal. But again, this slight loss of perspective in terms of what is important, and I think you touched on something. Yes, we do talk about, you know, men should talk about their feelings more and, you know, connect with their inner emotions. But I think it's easier said than done. And, you know, he really didn't want to lose this. And he felt losing would, you know, really undermine his persona. And he felt that that would be a terrible thing in a way that I don't think I fully understood.
So your husband does this for whatever reason or combination of reasons. You write at one point, 5 minutes to end one life and upend the lives of so many others. Seth made a snap decision, one of millions over his 50 years. Most were inconsequential. One was irreversible. This decision, of course, to end his life. As you talk about and you describe in just breathtaking detail what it was like when it was, I think, a state trooper who comes to the house, and by this point you were already very fearful. He was had been missing for some hours, and you feared the worst, and this confirmed the worst. As you're writing about the immediate wake of this tragedy, One of the things you write about is how, although your background is Jewish, your parents did not really have much use for organized religion. And so, in your words, I was unschooled in the Jewish practices surrounding death. And you write, part of me was glad for this. Can you explain why you actually felt some relief at that not being a part of this moment in your life?
Yes, I think that there was a specific reason to write that, because honestly, if I had organized religion of any kind, and of Judaism in particular, you know, there is a structure that really supports those who are grieving, and, you know, that would have been a comfort. But because that was unfamiliar to me, just I think that I was speaking just about the Shiva, which is a practice of, you know, people coming over to your home and there's a lot of food involved. And
right.
We did that, you know, we had people coming over and there was a lot of food, but I just didn't want it to be organized. I wanted it to be on my terms. I mean, the first thing I thought when I got the news was my kids, my girls. I just thought, this is the end of their childhood. We are doomed. And that became my immediate focus, and honestly, my focus over the last 10 years.
Of course.
And so I just wanted to be able to close the door if I wanted and be with them and sit and watch Gilmore Girls and, you know, eat dinner on the couch in front of a movie. I wanted to be able to shut out the world if I wanted to and just be with my kids. And that's what I meant in that sentence about I was glad I didn't have to adhere to any structures. I mean, I completely relied on my community. And, you know, I talk about this a lot in the book, where in our unluckiness, we were actually fairly lucky. I mean, Seth had left life insurance, and so we were financially, materially secure. We could stay in our home. The kids could stay in the school they'd been at since they were 4 years old. So there was that sense of continuity and safety and security. I had an amazing circle of mostly moms, friends, you know, my kids' friends, mothers, who fed me and took my calls in the middle of the night and drove my kids to taekwondo and gymnastics and birthday parties and anything I needed. And so the community was central. It's really a large part of what saved us. And so I just think I wanted I'm kind of a control freak, and so I wanted the control of being able to chart my path in terms of what we needed in the moment.
Right.
And not what any kind of religion dictated.
Sure.
But again, you know, it was all, you know, in Judaism, it's about the community. In most religions, after death, it's about community support. And so in that sense, it was similar to having some kind of faith-based approach.
Right.
But it just wasn't specific.
Right. And I think, I mean, I'm Lutheran. I'm not deeply acquainted with, you know, the tradition you are talking about, but even in my own and in many others, a lot of times what it sort of feels like in that moment is that you are grief-stricken. We sweep in and give you what you need, and even if it's
exactly.
And sometimes even in very secular circumstances where it's a funeral at a funeral home, but often, you know, a funeral director will be kind of telling you what's going to happen next and this is best and so on, and thinking that they're sort of relieving you of something, and you felt the need, and I think understandably, to direct how you and your family were going to proceed. You also write something interesting in the moment where you're talking about, for instance, your husband's life insurance policy and the anxiety you felt until it was clear that at least most of its benefits would be honored, you know, even though he had, you know, chosen to end his life. You write, at the time, I didn't feel as lucky as I was. And yeah. I think that's that's probably a very common state of affairs for a whole lot of people experiencing a lot of different things, that we often in the moment do not, maybe are not capable of understanding how fortunate we are. And I thought that was an interesting turn of phrase.
Right. Well, I write in the book, the day Seth died, my older daughter came to me and said, will we ever be happy again? And I said to her, yes, but I completely didn't believe it. I thought, as I said earlier, their childhood had been, you know, cut short, and we were kind of this doomed family. Like, who gets over that? An eight-year-old who, you know, my kids were just so in love with their dad, and he was in love with them. And so I really didn't know how a family gets over something like this. But I think part of the reason that I wrote the book was to show that, you know, even in tragedy, it is human nature to move toward joy and pleasure over time and in perhaps not the ways you imagine. But I honestly didn't think we would sort of come back to life intact. But by, you know, the kids and I, you know, we became this kind of unit moving through our lives, and we became very close. And, you know, I began to really listen to what they needed as opposed to what I thought they needed. So, for instance, you know, I grew up in New York. A lot of kids were in therapy by high school, you know, and for much less severe reasons than a death like this. But I assumed my kids would just go right to therapy and that would be that. But, you know, when I asked my older daughter about going into therapy, she was kind of like, okay, so you want me to sit in an office with some person that I've never met and talk to them about my dead father? No, thank you. You know, she was just like, how could that possibly help me? And so I was sort of like, okay, fine, you don't have to do that. You know, and then my younger daughter went to this grief group. It was like a grief support group with me, where she went with the kids, and they didn't talk about their dead parents. They did art projects and painted rocks and, you know, jumped on a trampoline, but they all knew that they had had a similar loss, and that was very helpful. And for me, it was helpful to be with the adults upstairs, because that's when I realized how lucky I was. I mean, some people didn't have that money left to them, and they had to move away from their families or their support systems. And, you know, I met fathers in particular who had not been involved in child rearing. And I remember a dad said in this group, I've never even made a sandwich for my kid.
Wow.
You know, so I thought, yeah. So, you know, again, perspective and the realization that in this terrible situation, we have a lot going for us.
Right. I appreciate how honestly and openly you write about the period not long after the memorial service when you and your two daughters went to stay with your mother for a couple of months in her cottage. And your parents had divorced when you were a very young child, and yeah. It was a very, very painful, angry divorce. And it was interesting how at one point, as you and your mother are talking, she doesn't say this to you early, but at some point she felt moved to say, you know, I was abandoned too. She was, at least to some extent, likening her loss when her husband, your father, essentially walked out of the marriage. And this was something you just could not accept, what you called her distorted symmetry. Can you just say a quick word about what you think was going on there inside of you and why this
right.
was so difficult for you to hear?
Right. I mean, my mother was just trying to be supportive, right? But
of course.
It enraged me. It enraged me because I felt that her comparison of my dad leaving and their divorce with my husband who died was just incredibly unsympathetic and just ridiculously wrong. You know, I mean, my father moved 4 blocks away from my mother in Brooklyn, so we saw him every weekend. He was in our lives throughout our childhood, and that he, you know, he was, they didn't get along, but he was there. And so to compare that to my situation where my kids lost their father and, quote, you know, that he was gone, you know, that just made me, that made me just very, very angry. And I will say, you know, this was weeks after he died. And so I was in a very raw, volatile, emotional state during that period of time. And, you know, I've come to actually understand it more and over years and, you know, with my mother, who is 88 and still very close to my kids. In fact, my older daughter, who goes to college in New York, is now living with my mother. But that's for another book. But I've come to understand and appreciate that there were similarities, that she felt completely abandoned. And it didn't matter that he was, you know, still in the neighborhood, that she, you know, I think people can experience divorce as a, there's a feeling of death about it, the death of the marriage. And I understand that comparison. It was just, you know, everything's timing, and the timing of her saying that was just unfortunate.
Right.
But I have come to understand that comparison and appreciate it, even though I still don't think it's exactly right. But
right.
If she said that to me today, I would engage in a conversation. I wouldn't storm out of the room and slam my door.
Exactly. One of the reasons I wanted to mention that is because of another line that you write in that same chapter, you know, kind of talking about this, when you say these really interesting words, helping me was nearly impossible. In other words, you were at a point in your life and in your grief when there was essentially nothing that anybody could say or do that was going to be of at least significant help to you. At least that's the way it felt to you. And maybe that was even really the way it was. And it's just kind of interesting to think about what it's like to be at that kind of point in one's life where you are experiencing something and you feel like there's no way anybody can help me with this. And in some ways it feels maybe eerily similar to the dark feelings that, for instance, your husband had just before his suicide.
Yes, that's an interesting take. I think, you know, it was particularly true because I was in this little cottage in the woods with my mother and my kids. And, you know how when you're with your parents, you're kind of brought back to your worst adolescent
yeah.
self.
Oh, yes.
I was kind of in at my worst adolescent self in that at that time. And, you know, partly I felt like that because, you know, it was my mother, and I could express I could be the worst of myself. You know how our kids, you know, they're fine all day and then they come home and collapse. It was a little bit of that going on.
So in other words, this was really true in that moment and in that setting. This
I believe
sense
so.
that nobody could help you in that. It was impossible for you to be helped. But I'm glad to, and that makes perfect sense now as you explain that.
Because as soon as I came back to reality and my house, I realized how much help I needed and would now be forced to accept and be able to accept. I mean, I had kids later. Seth and I, my first kid was born when I was 38 and the second at 41. So I kind of had my career and felt like, you know, I was a grown up and knew what's what and how the world worked. And so, you know, I was one of those moms who was like, I got this. I know how to do this. I don't need help. You know, that was also something comparable with Seth and I. You know, I don't need help. But then as soon as he died, I realized, like, we need help, and it's okay to ask. And, in fact, it's healthy to ask. And that's one thing that I've talked to my kids about a lot, that it's a sign of strength to ask for help, not a sign of weakness.
Hmm.
So, you know, you can't sustain a life feeling like no one can help you and angry and volatile all the time. That's not a long-term solution. So I was in that dark space for, you know, it was about 2 months after he died. And then I realized, like, you can't live like this.
Of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And of course, much of the book is about the journey out of that terrible place.
Yes.
Into a better place. And
yes.
That journey for you and your daughters included the moment you decided to ask your daughters if the three of you should throw a party for your husband. And the giving of parties became one of the through lines of this journey towards something better. Can you just say a quick word? We're almost out of time, I'm afraid, but a quick word about what kind of healing took place in that simple little act.
Right. Well, so the book starts out, Seth and I both turned 50 the same year, and you know, we had this great party for him where all of our friends came with their kids, and it was like grilling in the front yard, playing games, capture the flag. And it was just such a joy-filled party. And, you know, it was coming up on May of 2015, almost a year after his death. And it was, you know, I sort of was like, it's time to feel some joy, maybe. Maybe we can figure this out. And I thought, let's do the same party, invite the same people and have them come over and do like casual front yard games with kids. And they were kind of lukewarm at the beginning, like, how would this work? Would it be messy and emotional? My older daughter was kind of like, really? You know, this is going to be soppy and crying. And she'd had enough of that, I think. But we had the same people came. It was torrential rain, but it was just so beautiful. And, you know, a sense of just sort of like the people who had saved us that first year. And so we just decided to make it a tradition. And it was just, you know, every year we got together, and it was a way to see progress, emotional stability growing. And, you know, we had survived another year, and so had our friends, you know, and everybody, just there was a sense of love and remembering Seth and what we loved about him, but also, you know, that we were all there for each other.
Rachel Zimmerman's book is Us After, a memoir of love and suicide. More of our conversation can be heard in the podcast version of The Morning Show. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.